This is KOOP HD1 HD3 Hornsby. Welcome to Civil Rights and Wrongs, the state of your civil liberties in the Lone Star State. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of the co-op board of directors, staff, volunteers, or underwriters. The following program was homecrafted and recorded on January 7th. Thanks for the handoff, Rocky. In November, the Texas Tribune reported that a temporary federal moratorium on evictions had ended in August. Since then, eviction filings in Dallas, Houston, and Fort Worth have risen almost to pre-pandemic levels. On top of all the economic stressors associated with the pandemic, major metropolitan areas in Texas have also seen a dramatic increase in rent, driven by the lack of affordable housing statewide. They quote a legal aid attorney who calls it a black hole for their clients. Quote, "It absolutely sucks the financial life out of our applicants." On December 31st, the Austin Chronicle reported that Travis County Precinct 5 Justice of the Peace, Nick Chu, extended eviction protections to renters in Travis County due to the pandemic. The order delays eviction trials for unpaid rent to be paused for 30 days so that renters can seek rental assistance, consult pro bono attorneys, and negotiate a settlement to avoid eviction. The order will stay in effect through March 1, 2022. At the same time, the Travis County Emergency Rental Assistance Program is no longer accepting new applications for assistance. Good evening and welcome to Civil Rights and Wrongs on Co-op 91.7 in Austin, streaming through koop.org. I'm your host, Bob Daly. Our guests this evening include Shoshana Krieger and Mincho Jacob from Building and Strengthening Tenant Action. BASTA describes itself as organizers, researchers, community educators, paralegals, and lawyers who work collectively with tenants to break down the barriers to healthy living and safe housing. We also have Joao Paulo Conley, Director of Community Housing and Development at the Austin Justice Coalition. AJC serves people who are historically and systematically impacted by gentrification, segregation, over-policing, a lack of educational and employment opportunities, and other institutional forms of racism in Austin. In addition, we have Jim Harrington, retired founder of the Texas Civil Rights Project, and Michelle Manning Scott, associate producer of the show. Good evening, and thanks all of you for joining us. I'd like to first hear from each of you. Tell us a little about yourselves and how you got into this business. So let's lead off with Shoshana.
Hi, thanks for having us. It's lovely to be here. So I'm Shoshana Krieger, and I'm the project director of BASTA. And what got me involved with BASTA and the work that we do in Austin is that there was no organized tenant presence in Austin, no organization which was dedicated solely to organizing tenants in the Austin community, and an overall dearth of tenant organizing in Texas, largely because the laws are stacked against tenants, and it's really hard to exert power as a tenant in Texas. So BASTA has been around for the last 6 years working to organize tenants to be able to take back some of that power and to be able to shift the power dynamics and landlord-tenant relationships. Personally, what got me involved in this work is that without having a safe and stable and healthy home, it's really hard to combat any of the other myriad problems which come as a result of much larger structures in our society, which create poverty, and having a safe and stable home is crucial to being able to combat all of the other myriad of wrongs which are occurring currently in our society. When you see that over 55% of Austinites are renters and 70% of Black Austinites are renters and 2/3 of Latinx Austinites are renters, we really need to be focusing on stabilizing the housing and ensuring that those in rental housing are able to have permanency in their housing and stability in their housing to be able to continue the myriad of other fights which we engage in alongside many of our allies.
Well, thanks for that. Mincho, tell us a little about your own background and history with BASTA.
Well, I was fortunate enough to start working with BASTA just before the pandemic. I think I got 2 weeks of tight teamwork, working together, working in the field, and then the pandemic happened. So a lot of my organizing with BASTA has been in this crazy time period that we've been in. But I've also lived and organized in East Austin since the mid-90s, first moved to Austin in 1996, when it was a place for musicians and you could work at a coffee shop at $6 an hour and actually live here. But there was still a lot of bad housing then and a lot of segregation, which exists to this day. So I've always been really interested in working with communities of color, especially, and looking at dispossession of wealth and looking at how segregation affects everybody, especially now in East Austin today. You still see people live in things like subsidized housing, but have had their wealth stolen for generations. Families that helped start Clarksville and folks that got displaced during the construction of MOPAC and now live in East Austin and they're getting displaced again. So it's really important to talk about these families that live on the side of town. And especially as we're seeing gentrification grow, it's really interesting to be working and organizing with folks, not just for healthy housing, but also how to be a part of the vibrant economy that Austin is booming in.
And Joao, you're with the Austin Justice Coalition. We've had Chaz Moore on a couple times, as well as Chris Harris. So I think we're somewhat familiar with the mission of the AJC, but I didn't realize that there were housing programs. So tell us a little about you and what you do for AJC.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here. My current title is actually the organizing director for AJC. Mm-hmm. So although I joined the team hyper-focused on housing, right now my job is to sort of try to build more of a grassroots organizing operation for the organization. But housing is still sort of a top of mind issue. It's something that's very close to my heart. Myself, I'm a renter, have been a low income renter for most of my life and identify very much with struggles and issues faced by renters in Austin. And AJC's participation in housing space and housing policy has been mostly focused on policy, not so much direct service. Although, as was mentioned a little earlier, you know, during the winter storm, we joined BASTA and other organizations to get out and provide urgent assistance to folks. Usually when we've been looking at housing policy, we focused on things like the city's land development code, focused on larger questions around zoning. And we also focus on policies, resolutions, stuff coming from city council, from the county commissioner's court that affect the lives of tenants and working class people of color in Austin. I have to make a quick comment, which is, as we enter this discussion about displacement and housing stabilization, you know, I would be remiss if I didn't say a word for the folks at the Ventura Apartments off Runberg. Last night, there was a fire at the apartment, and we don't know all the details, but it seems like a number of folks had to go to the hospital, and that fire will likely lead to the displacement of the folks who live there, many of the folks who live there. And it's one of the lower income apartment complexes that we have in that part of town. So the tragic loss in our housing supply. And I just wanted to acknowledge that these things happen quite frequently, not just winter storms, fires. There's always stuff taking place, sometimes intentionally, sometimes not so intentionally. Some of the history that Mincho mentioned that really continues to displace tenants throughout the city, and displacement is the norm in Austin. It's been the status quo since the 1930s and earlier.
Well, thank you for that. Shoshana, you threw out some statistics. One of the key ones is that the majority of Austin's residents live in rental housing, and that number is even higher, as you point out, Joelle, for minority residents. You know, I think that gets lost on a lot of people, especially as people have focused on the high cost of ownership housing. I just saw the other night that for this past year, rents have gone up 25%.
A lot of the statistics which have been reported say that rents are going up by large amounts. In one affordable complex, which we're organizing in, supposedly affordable, I'm doing affordable in air quotes, rents went up to $400 a month. It was a tax credit property in the Metropolis neighborhood. And that's not unheard of. And that's supposed to be a low-income, affordable community. So tenants are really struggling to pay those rents. And many of our policies in the city are focused on homeowner stabilization. This past year, with increasing the homestead exemption, what that does is it shifts the tax burden to renters and to commercial properties. And so there's relief for wealthy homeowners in West Austin, along with low-income homeowners throughout the city, but the vast majority of that relief is going to wealthier individuals, while renters are going to be the ones who have to absorb that cost. And so the fact that majority of Austinites are renters and the vast majority of Austinites of color are renters really should be directing some of our policy decisions in terms of where relief is targeted.
So renters are caught in a real bind here, especially during the pandemic. Rents have skyrocketed. There's certainly been a lot of economic stress on everyone, but especially low-income persons. And then I'm curious, what's been the situation regarding the condition of rental housing during the pandemic? Have complaints also gone up, or have those remained relatively constant?
I think we've seen conditions haven't improved at all. I mean, it's very difficult, especially for families who are struggling just to isolate or be aware of COVID in their lives. To have somebody else come into their home is very difficult. There's also what we've seen in a lot of places is not enough staff in apartments. It could be that there is no staff, but it could also be excuses that we hear that, oh, maintenance can't be done. And that was especially what we saw after the winter storm, that maintenance had to wait for parts, for supply chain, for plumbers and the like. So even right now, I think we've definitely seen places that are not getting repairs done because apartment complexes are claiming that they're not able to staff maintenance positions. So we don't see an improvement at all. And I think probably to the contrary, things are getting worse.
And if I could jump in here, I think that this kind of sets the stage for sort of the landscape around rental housing in Austin. And that is, a lot of the lower income tenants in Austin live in apartment buildings that we think of as affordable or deeply affordable housing, but they're what we call market rate affordable or naturally occurring affordable housing. In other words, it's housing that happens to be affordable only because the building is already very old. That property gets passed around like a hot potato between different property management companies who pick it up, do the famous lipstick on a pig, you know, make it look kind of nice, manage it for a couple of years, and then hand it off to the next company. So we have quite a few properties in Austin that are like that, that are in that situation. There's nothing actually protecting the affordability in those properties or keeping those properties from eventually redeveloping. So there's quite a few landlords that are really sitting on these old properties, just kind of biding their time, you know, waiting for the opportunity to redevelop and letting the existing structure just kind of decay. That is just kind of a real fact about the current landscape for renters in Austin. You don't have many affordable properties where you actually have some kind of income restriction. A lot of that's just really kind of depends on the market right now.
You know, in preparing for the show, I was trying to track the various assistance programs during the pandemic and the eviction moratoriums that have occurred. And I quickly got lost, but my general sense is that city and county assistance programs, if they haven't ended, they are drying up pretty quickly, and that eviction moratoriums are just about at the end as well. Certainly in other cities, Dallas, Houston, Fort Worth have seen eviction rates go back up to pre-pandemic levels. Could we focus a little, though, on Austin and Travis County? I'd like to hear a little about what's happened with assistance and what's going on with eviction as well.
So in Travis County and Austin, since the beginning of the pandemic, we've had some form of eviction protections for tenants through mayoral and county judge orders limiting the giving of notices to vacate, through city council with an ordinance which provided tenants an opportunity to pay back rent if they weren't able to pay on time, and then also through the courts themselves pausing hearings. As you said, Bob, most of those protections expired at the end of 2021. So now as we are in 2022, we're kind of in a whole new world. And one thing which we saw as the protections were starting to lift and were being wound down is we saw an increase in filings. So throughout the pandemic, we were seeing maybe 20 or 30 evictions being filed a week. And in the week of December 12th, that number jumped up to 95. And we expect those numbers to increase as we are more in 2022. We do have a Travis County Justice of the Peace Courts, which are the courts where evictions are held. I did announce that they have extended protections a bit. So right now through March, if a landlord files, the hearing for the eviction case won't be set until 30 days after the filing. So that gives tenants a little bit more time, but it's nowhere near the protections that tenants had during the pandemic. And then on the flip side, you're pointing out rental assistance programs, which have really dried up. So a lot of funds came through the federal government and were being administered by the state through Texas Rent Relief, the city through the rent program, and the county through the Emergency Rental Assistance Program. And the end of last year, all of those programs with very little notice announced, oh, wow, we've actually spent most of our money and so no one else can apply. So there have been these messages of tenants, don't worry, we have all this money. And then all of a sudden, the money dried up. There are some expectations that some additional funds will be coming down the pipe in the next couple of months as the federal government looks at jurisdictions which haven't spent out their money, same with the state. And some of that may be shifted to our local programs. The jury is still out on that, and that's not helping the tenants who may be facing eviction 2 weeks or a month from now.
Do you have any sense about the magnitude of the problem here? I mean, surely we must be looking at thousands of families that are at risk at this point.
I don't know if we have a solid statistic on that, but we do know that applications to Travis County Emergency Rental Assistance Program and Austin Rent and Texas Rental Relief skyrocketed in December, which is why they ran out of money so fast. And tenants are still very much in need. And now they find themselves that really we're at the height of the pandemic without any kind of support structure that existed. In the last year and a half, we did have very robust protections compared to a lot of other jurisdictions. Austin and Travis County had much lower COVID numbers compared to something like Harris County, which has allowed many more evictions over the last year. So there is a lot of need right now. We get contacted every day for folks trying to find rental assistance. I spoke to some financial counselors at Foundation Communities yesterday who were also trying to search for it. And they were like, we have a lot of folks looking for money for rent, just immediate. It's not folks that are months and months behind. It's people who are a month or two behind at most because of, like you see the spike in Omicron. People lose out on a week or two of wages because, you know, a restaurant shuts down for a while. And like, that's the real, real need. And those folks will end up being evicted because there is no remedy right now for those tenants.
I think that the lack of data on this, of how many people are affected, highlights the lack of information that we have on tenancies before there's actually a filing in the courts. Once there's a filing in the courts, we may have some numbers, but there's been many informal evictions, like thousands upon thousands, which have occurred during the pandemic, which there is no way to track because so much of the landlord-tenant relationship exists outside of anything which is tracked. And so folks are oftentimes forced to move without us knowing about it, or they need rental assistance and they're at the precipice of being displaced, but we have no idea because we don't, as city and a county, have systems to be able to track this information to really have a solid understanding of the problem. And without a solid understanding, we're not going to be devising effective and actionable solutions to those problems.
Yeah, that's right. We don't have any accurate sort of way to keep track right now, monitor all of the rental properties in Austin. But I do think it's safe to assume that the problem is probably much bigger than many of us imagine it to be. And, you know, a quick addition here, which is that, you know, another aspect of the work that AJC does is advocating for housing for our unhoused neighbors and advocating for folks experiencing homelessness in Austin. That was one of the big hot topic issues of 2021 with the Prop B election and all that. But one of the things that people often forget is that statistically, a very large percentage, more than the majority of folks experiencing homelessness right now in Austin became homeless for the first time while living in Austin. So it's a large quantity of folks who had housing at some point and lost it. When you start looking at low income tenants who are on the brink of eviction and folks in our community who are experiencing homelessness, there's almost this kind of gray area where we really don't know, right? How many folks are kind of moving out of their housing and just onto the street because they've lost it. If we as a community, for instance, want to address the crisis around the number of folks experiencing homelessness in Austin, then stabilizing our renters as a city, taking responsibility for that and saying that we're going to have to acknowledge there's a large population of folks with unpaid back rent and we need to do something about that. And that's our problem collectively as a city that we have to take care of is crucial if we want to reduce and support the populations of folks experiencing homelessness.
When it comes down to discussions of evictions, you really do need to get the municipalities involved in this, it seems to me.
Yeah, but I don't think that you get the municipalities and you don't get policy change without organized constituencies. Mm-hmm. Because power knows the truth and power doesn't care. And so what organizing I think fundamentally about is saying, we don't care that you don't care. We need to reclaim some power and actually force power to enact policies which are more equitable and enact policies which are going to support tenants in being able to exert some power, to be able to have more time to repay their rent, to be able to have additional defenses to an eviction, to be able to call the code department and have an officer come out and say, that's mold, and force the landlord to make that repair, and the tenant can remain in their home after that repair is made, and the tenant isn't just kicked out because their lease can be non-renewed at the very first moment. To get those policies at the municipal and the state level requires the organizing of tenants property by property and then citywide.
As you point out, Shoshana, a lot of these programs expired just a week ago. Do you feel like you're sitting on a volcano that's about to erupt here? Or what's your sense of a strategy for how to deal with all this at the moment?
Well, I think I may kick this to Mean Joe, who's been heading our Eviction Solidarity Network, which is a coalition of organizations, including BOSTA, AJC, Austin Tenants Council, Texas Housers, POC, and DSA, which really has been observing and responding to tenants who are right now facing eviction and kind of are seeing a great increase and are also figuring out the best way to respond. Mean Joe, do you want to talk a little bit about that and what you're seeing?
Sure. Like Shoshana said earlier, we had an increase in eviction filings, really starting since October. It had slowly been going up. And then, yeah, the last part of December really jumped up a lot. We have not seen a huge number of filings this week, which is the first week really of 2022, but we do expect it to be coming. We do know that there are a lot of folks who have been protected by the notice to vacate order of the county judge and the mayor over the last year and a half, and the rental assistance that was out there available. We are seeing a lot more hearings getting scheduled. Now a lot of those cases that were abated last year that were not able to be heard, they're now scheduling them a lot. And there's not a lot of flexibility that you see in court. I mean, basically judges and most of the parties there are like, you tenant, you've had plenty of time to get everything sorted out. And if you haven't been able to get your stuff together, too bad, so sad, you get evicted. Just this week in court, I know we saw a case, one of our volunteers, a gentleman had lost his job 3 times. And to no fault of his own, I mean, he works in the service industry. He had lost his job 3 times because of shutdowns or slowdowns in business. And he had gotten rental assistance back in September. It paid off a lot of his back owed rent. He owed just under $2,500, I think, right now, which is not a ton of money. And the landlord had filed for an immediate possession. So he was evicted and a writ of possession could be issued the next day and not with a lot of recourse. But this is just a gentleman who really didn't do anything wrong. I saw a case a month ago where it was 3 elderly veterans in a house. And also they just didn't have any way to make income. They kept on losing all of their opportunities to do so. And they owed, I think it was around $15,000. So they're left with that debt, with an eviction on their record. What happens to those folks now? They're going to be homeless. They're going to not be able to access services. One thing I just wanted to interject to this conversation too is there's a view of renters a lot of times as not stable just because they're not able to buy a house. They're not the same as a homeowner. But there's a lot of reasons why folks may or may not own a home. And a lot of our frontline workers over the last 2 years have been folks that are not making a ton of money. If you work at HEB, you were deemed a frontline worker. But where are you now if you're losing hours or you're unable to make rent? You could end up homeless despite being lauded just a few months ago. So I think we're expecting to see a lot more evictions coming up, and we're definitely seeing a lot less patience, if you will, on the side of the courts for giving tenants a little leeway, whatever leeway may be available. They're not getting that to the tenants, or even saying, we'll give you a week to pay back rent and we'll come back and do a continuance on this case. That's not even being considered at the moment.
We need to take a short station break, but we'll be right back. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Civil Rights and Wrongs on Co-op 91.7 in Austin, streaming through koop.org. I'm your host, Bob Daly. This evening's show was homecrafted and recorded on January 7th. Our guests this evening include Shoshana Krieger and Mincho Jacob from BASTA and Joao Paulo Conley from AJC. We're talking about looming evictions. Let's pick up where we left off.
And part of what Eviction Solidarity Network and ESN is doing is also responding to the cases that they're seeing. So when there's a tenant who, if they were connected with resources, might be able to win their case, making sure to make contact with the tenant, calling tenants who are at risk of eviction, who we know there's been filings on, and connecting them to resources ahead of time. In some of the courts right now, with the program with volunteer services, tenants are connected automatically with attorneys. So ESN has been working, observing many of these injustices, trying to connect directly with tenants to ensure they know their rights, and then also providing feedback to the courts about some of the patterns that we are seeing, which with slight changes, be able to reduce the number of folks who actually have eviction judgments against them.
To add to that, where do we go in terms of broader strategy on a city level? I think a basic thing that we should establish, it's kind of obvious, is that the pandemic is not over. It's far from over. We don't know how the virus is going to mutate. We're seeing the Omicron resurgence of cases. We know that even folks who have been vaccinated, gotten all three shots, could still get pretty sick at home at times. So we don't know all the details around how this thing is going to evolve, but it is not over. We're not at the tail end of it. We're in the thick of it. And I think it's not super encouraging. I think we need to start from that place and not act as though we're about to sort of transition back into some sort of normal world, the way things were before the pandemic. No, we're still in the middle of it. And our courts, our city council, our county commissioner's court should treat the situation accordingly, as though we were really still in the middle of a serious pandemic, which we are, but we can sometimes tend to forget that. And I think another piece that I would add is, for a long time, you know, before BASTA came around, tenants in Austin have been largely ignored as a political group of constituents. Their power hasn't really been taken seriously by our elected officials. This is an election year. We're going to have two big, important election cycles this year. And we have to make sure that tenants' rights, tenant protections, eviction prevention is a central issue to all the upcoming election campaigns. I mean, every single elected official in Austin and Travis County should be making a very strong public commitment. And more than just a commitment, they should show a plan for how they're going to address and prevent the eviction crisis that we're in and that's looming. So I think making this a central issue in the upcoming election will be absolutely crucial.
To that point, currently only two of the Austin City Council members are renters themselves. And, you know, that plays into a lot of who has the power and the shared experience of issues that come up.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And even if you look at things like, for instance, you know, zoning cases, right? It's very common and understood that, you know, the developer who's proposing some kind of a zoning change in an area will reach out to the neighborhood contact team and will speak to the local homeowners association, and they'll show up and testify at the planning commission. But renters, who sometimes are the majority of the residents in that very neighborhood, are almost always completely left out of the discussion, right? They're not treated as sort of a voice to come to the table, to be included, to be reached out to. They're just kind of ignored. And then we see that again at city council. There's just a general tendency to ignore renters or push them out of the conversation. And, you know, as Mincho said, to sort of assume, well, renters are transient. And sometimes renters themselves need help to realize that they have that power, that agency, and the ability to show up and advocate for their rights.
And renters are largely transient because of policies we have in place, because there is generally no right to renew your lease in Texas. And so the permanency issues of renters, it's a chicken and egg, that a large part of that is that tenants aren't offered housing stability. And many tenants, I think, would prefer to be able to remain in one place, in one community, know their neighbors, develop deeper roots, but they don't, because they're pushed out by rapidly increasing rents place to place, and also in search of housing, which isn't falling apart, that a lot of the folks we work with go from place to place in search of a apartment which doesn't have mold, in search of an apartment which doesn't have roaches. So if we solved that part of the housing equation, we also would probably have more stability and less transience among renters.
Jim, you know, we're talking about evictions and people moving into a homeless state. What are you seeing in the churches on this issue? I mean, have you had parishioners come to you that are facing eviction, for example?
Yeah, this is actually an enormous problem, and it's been exaggerated by COVID. So folks who are getting COVID can't work, or they're on crews in which somebody has had COVID and everybody's laid off for the time being. You know, people barely were able to pay their rent, but now you have this situation where people can't be working to earn the money. So it is a really great problem. I mean, everything that's been talked about is right on. And I really commend everybody that's involved in this effort. And I strongly support the idea, you know, that we have to really engage in organizing. Texas law is pathetic when it comes to protecting renters. And I totally agree that the only way that this is going to be dealt with is really some hardcore on the ground organizing. It's going to get worse You know, we sort of have this thinking right now, well, we're coming out of COVID, you know, that's sort of out there, or you can't get as sick. But the problem is, even if you don't get as sick, you're still not working. Just today, you know, I have one family in which both the father and the mother who do basically day jobs, he does stonework, and he already has health issues. And then the mother cleans houses. And they were knocked out for a little bit more than a week because they tested positive. And consequences that's going to have shortly in terms of being able to make the payment is something that I'm really dreading to see coming down the pike. So once again, I just really applaud and thank everybody here today for the fantastic and critical work that they're doing. And it shows the interplay, I think, of all of the issues that we're facing with respect to our economic system. I want to do anything that we can, you know, to help this move forward. This is right on.
So what can renters do to protect themselves?
Organize would be my first response, because if you are standing up to your landlord and you're by yourself, it's pretty easy for your landlord to retaliate. But if you're standing up to your landlord and you have 100 of your neighbors with you, it's hard for your landlord to evict all of you. That requires a serious organizing and base building and solidarity. And that's not something which is going to happen overnight or even in a week. It requires talking, it requires community building, it requires a lot of hard work. But that fundamentally, in a state like Texas, where we have so few rights for tenants, sometimes organizing is the way to get the things which you do not have a right to. And we've seen that with tenants successfully kicking out of their properties, bullying managers, and getting repairs which were long overdue, which the code department might not have been requiring to be made, but successful tenant associations we've worked with have been able to get those repairs. Or at North Lamar Mobile Home Park, that residents association bought their property and are now running it as a co-op. And that was the dream that they had. And now they really are exerting, you know, control over their destiny. On an individual level, I would say what renters can do to protect themselves is document everything which is happening. If you are going into the management office and you think that the manager is going to say one thing and then potentially do something different in the future, you can record that conversation. Take a picture of your money order before you submit it. Just make sure everything is documented, because oftentimes it becomes a he said, she said situation. And who the courts are going to believe is not going to be the tenant, it's going to be the landlord.
Yeah, I was going to say document everything too. That is so vitally important. In eviction courts, we see tenants come in and say, you know, the landlord told me this, or I did pay this, but they have no evidence. And the judge is going to go with the landlord 99.9% of the time. So it's very, very important. Like Shoshana said, you can record a conversation, put it in your pocket. It doesn't have to be video. It could be audio. It goes a long way too. And, you know, even in the last month, there was an apartment complex down in D4. They had filed 12 filings. And this one family there, the mother of the family, like, she had everything documented. I mean, everything to a T. She read her paperwork when it came in, because that's very important too. Read notices and look at them really closely. They had filed and they had said that they had given her a 30-day notice, which they hadn't, which was required by the CARES Act. And that company had attested to the court that they had indeed. So she got the case dismissed. She hustled, she called the courts and advocated for herself. So I think that's a really important thing too, is don't be afraid. And if you don't know how to advocate for yourself, reach out to ADC, to us. There's a lot of different people, Austin Tenants Council. And there's a lot of good websites out there. Eviction Is Not a Cure is one that we as Eviction Solidarity Network operate. BostaAustin.org, but there's also Texas Rio Grande Legal Aid, Texas Law Help, lots of places to look for and reach out for help, because if you can document and you have evidence and you can advocate for yourself, you can go a long way on doing things, even in this bad environment that tenants find themselves in.
Well, you took the words out of my mouth there. I was just going to ask you about resources. So thank you for that. Just wondering if you had any concluding thoughts about what should be happening or about what could happen in a better world.
It starts from the things that Shoshana and Mincho have already said, which is that organizing power and building relationships with your fellow tenants, building relationships with other renters in the city, and that strong network of solidarity amongst renters where we say, we're renters, we're here to stay, you know, we're going to be here for the long haul. We make up 55% or more of the residents of this city. We demand that our rights be guaranteed, you know, that our voices be heard and included in these processes moving forward. We insist on coming to the table and participating in future city policy discussions. And I think that if we could have that organized, united tenants' voice in this city, that would change a whole lot about what is a priority, how we keep track of data, how we monitor property management companies and landlords and ensure that tenants' rights are guaranteed. And I think that that would be a great foundation, a great place for us to start to build from. And I would like us to see a lot of change that can't happen easily in this city because of the tremendous limitations that are imposed on us by the state. And the state really does a lot of harm to tenants. And Texas is one of the places in the country, I believe, where, you know, tenants have the least rights. But I think there are still things that we can do as a city and in Travis County. And there's a lot that we could do through organizing.
And I think right now we're at a precipice with our COVID eviction protections right now lapsing. And while the pandemic has exacerbated the housing crisis, there's been a housing crisis all along. And there's been an eviction crisis all along. There were 12,000 evictions in 2019. And we've managed to, with the protections, slow that to just over 1,500 in 2021, right? Our world doesn't need to revert to the 12,000 in 2019. And we still have an opportunity to not have our world to go back. And we have an opportunity to re-envision and reimagine what housing stability looks like and what we as a community are going to do about our housing crisis, whether we are in a pandemic, which is going to worsen it, or not. This crisis is not because of COVID. This crisis is worsened by COVID, but this crisis is because of capital. It's because of lack of regulation. It's because of many, many structures. It's because of a lot, but we right now have, because of COVID, instituted policies which have dramatically decreased the number of evictions. And there's still the opportunity to extend those policies. There's still the opportunity to say, we don't want to go back. And I think exactly as JP was saying, that in order to not go back, organizing is a crucial component of that.
You know, one of my favorite quotes on this show last year was from Gus Bova from the Texas Observer. I asked him a similar question, and his response was, to paraphrase it, that the real problem is that the people who are serving Elon Musk his coffee can't afford to live here. Mincho, did you have anything to add?
I think folks on this panel and yourself, you encapsulated that really well. I think just humanity too. I mean, if I was to think of a better world, it's one that we see the humanity of everybody, that we're all equal and that all folks are just struggling to have stability, to have a decent life, to be able to provide for their families. And we see it, Joe Paulo mentioned, was, you know, property managers that start looking at tenants as like, y'all are all trying to not pay your rent and you're lazy. And so like moves to eviction go faster, to all the folks in the system just looking at each other with more humanity, I think would go a long way and help us to change the system a lot and get rid of these exploitative measures that we see in every place that we look. So yeah, I'm happy to be working with all these folks, and for folks like yourselves that are putting voices on the air to expand on that a lot. So thank you for what y'all do.
Well, thank you. We're really grateful that the three of you could join us and certainly wish you the best. There's a lot of people really relying on you at this point. So hang in there, and we certainly wish you a lot of success.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Keep up the good work.
Well, it's Thursday afternoon, January 13th, and once again, we're speaking with Austin Sanders, staff writer for the Austin Chronicle. How you doing today, Austin?
I'm doing all right. Thanks for having me on, Bob.
Beautiful afternoon today. I'm hoping that at least the D4 folks are able to get out to the polls on these nice days. But, you know, in the other 9 districts of the city, I think their focus may be on another race that's coming up.
Right. Yeah. We're going to be electing a new mayor next November, November 2022. We're going to have a mayoral election.
Do we have some candidates already declared for that?
Yeah, we've got 2 at this point with a couple more rumored to jump in, kind of more of a question of when rather than if. Last week, we had Celia Israel declare her candidacy. She's been exploring a run since last fall and then kind of made it official last week. Israel, of course, is a state representative, House District 50 in the Texas House of Representatives, kind of like a Northeast Austin district. She's represented that since 2014, where she's, you know, really gained a reputation as an effective policymaker and deal maker, really learned the rules of the House well and became effective on the microphones there, and kind of a transportation expert. Well, that was kind of one of her specialties in the House, which I think will be useful to her in her campaign for mayor, obviously, where transportation and especially now that we're in the middle of Project Connect is going to be such an important policy issue for this race.
Yeah, she certainly had the legislative experience. I guess she just wants to try out something new, huh?
Yeah. You know, it must be frustrating, I would think, for elected Democrats on the state level, kind of forever in the minority party, it seems, and unable to really kind of push for the kind of maybe transformative policy that you may believe in. And you can have, you know, potentially more impact at the local level, you know, on a city council or as a mayor. So it kind of makes sense that she's departing the state house to seek an office at City Hall.
Right. Well, who else has thrown their hat in the ring?
Thus far, the only other person is Jennifer Verdin, who listeners may remember as the Save Austin Now endorsed candidate in the District 10 council race. This is parts of Central and West and Northwest Austin, Council District 10, represented by Allison Alter. Verdin pushed Alter to a runoff in that race in 2020, where she, you know, ultimately lost. But it was, you know, maybe a little closer than Alter would have expected, although this district is probably one of the most conservative in the city, right? District 6 and District 10 probably have the most Republican voters. They both have changed a little bit after redistricting, but I would suspect that either of them are still going to have among the most Republican voters. So it's not terribly surprising that a Republican, really, you know, pretty far right-wing candidate would do well in that race. You know, it's interesting that Verdin would think that after forcing this runoff in a district race, that means that she has a chance of winning a citywide race in a city that is overwhelmingly Democratic. You know, there's probably about 20% of voters in Austin vote Republican. So clearly not enough to win the race, even in a fractured contest, right? We'll have multiple candidates before the filing deadline declare for mayor. So it's interesting that, you know, she is seeking this office. She's definitely a long shot at this point, although she will, it seems, be well-funded. Her first campaign finance report earlier this year showed that she had raised about $346,000. You need to raise probably about $1 million to kind of stand a chance to be elected mayor in Austin. So she's sort of on her way to do that, although I must note that $300,000 of that came from a loan that Verdin made herself, right? This is something that candidates do sometimes, especially wealthier candidates. Mayor Steve Adler loaned himself a substantial amount of his campaign contributions. So it's not like an uncommon practice. but it's something that Verdon has done. And I don't know how wealthy she is, but if she can write herself a similarly sized checks throughout the rest of the campaign, she may stand a chance of forcing a runoff, maybe not with herself in it, but certainly between other candidates, and possibly even making it into the runoff herself.
Hmm. Interesting. By your way to being mayor in Austin.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of a frequent criticism of Austin's local campaign finance rules, which in mayor and city council races, individuals, you know, like you and me, can't donate more than $400 to a particular candidate for mayor or city council. And this was, you know, in theory, trying to limit influence of wealthier donors. Of course, political action committees are legal. Political action committees or PACs will form in support of candidates to kind of get around that $400 limit, or wealthy candidates like Mayor Adler or Jennifer Verdon will just self-fund their campaigns, right? This is common knowledge in Austin that you either got to be able to self-finance a mayoral campaign or have access to a lot of money through donors or through people in PACs to stand a chance of being elected.
Yeah, it sort of boggles the mind. Well, they're the only two formal at this point. I did read somewhere that Kirk Watson is actually considering running for mayor again. Is that right?
Yeah. Kirk Watson has been kind of running around the city whispering to potential donors and other kind of political figures that he's exploring a run himself. He's been less public about it than Israel had been with her kind of formal exploratory committee. But it certainly seems like he's preparing to jump in the race. Part of the reason that Israel is announcing kind of relatively early is she can't self-finance her campaign. You know, she's a realtor, but not a super wealthy kind that can pay $1 million of her own money to finance a campaign. So she's announcing early so she can start collecting campaign contributions. Watson, to my understanding, maybe not has the kind of personal wealth to fund $1 million campaign, but he's got a lot of donors, right? He's been a Texas political figure for decades now. So he kind of have access to a pretty vast donor network, presumably that he could kind of be lining up right now in anticipation of an announcement. So Kirk Watson is one kind of rumored candidate. And then Kathy Tovo, who is currently serving on the city council representing District 9. She's been on the council for many years now. She actually is the only member to serve on the prior at-large council before the districts were created and on the council district version of council. She's kind of said that she's looking at a run as well. Again, District 9 is kind of downtown Central Austin and University of Texas. She would be an interesting candidate. You know, she's been one of these four consistent no votes on reforming the land development code. She's viewed as an ally the Austin Neighborhood Council and other neighborhood groups. So she would definitely, I think, be their preferred candidate. So again, she hasn't made any formal announcement as well, but she said that she's exploring a run closely.
Back in District 4, early voting has already begun. The actual voting date there is the 25th. Any new developments over there?
The two big ones, I guess, is that political action committees have entered this race. Two were created. One of them is called Voices for District 4. And this PAC is supporting one of the candidates, Jay Lavera, and opposing the race's frontrunner, Jose Chitovela. And the second PAC, called People Before Politics, is supporting Monica Guzman, another candidate in this race. And it's interesting that there are two PACs in what's going to be a relatively, you know, low turnout special election. After 2 days of early voting, just 220 people had voted in the race. You know, there's something like 30,000 voters in this district. So it's a pretty small number. Election watchers that I talked to suspect or estimate that will hit maybe between 2,000 or 3,000 voters total by election or after election day. So the fact that these political action committees have entered the race is interesting. And I think it kind of foreshadows what we can expect in November and the rest of the council races, you know, going back to that $400 maximum contribution limit in council and mayoral races, I think it's just recognition that Austin as a city is kind of outgrowing that. That's kind of not enough money to compete in a city the size of Austin. We're not quite at 1 million people, but we're pretty close. And so it's a lot harder to get your message out as a candidate when you have these contribution limits. And so I'd expect, based on the fact that these two PACs are in this kind of obscure, low turnout special election, that we'll see more of that in November when there's more attention from voters on the midterms and these down ballot races.
Well, lots to watch here on the election front. Thanks so much for joining us again, as always, and hope you have a great day today. And
yeah, I appreciate you having me on. Thanks again, Bob.
And that's all for this evening. Stay safe, everyone.